Chapter 7. Higher Learning. The trick, apparently, is to distribute the weight evenly so as to avoid pressure points. Astronauts often comment on the comfort of floating in the weightless environment of space. No pressure points. This lounge chair performs flawlessly. It makes me feel weightless. Or maybe it's the margarita. This morning was thrilling. After 4 weeks of learning the basics, turning, climbing, descending, and many takeoffs and landings, I flew my little plane solo for the first time. After a series of practice landings in the early light, Dan announced there was no reason to put him through any more punishment. He asked me to let him out of my plane and suggested I go do landings on my own. Takeoffs are relatively simple. After the airplane is lined up on the runway, smoothly advance the throttle. Use the rudder pedals to steer straight ahead. Once flying speed is achieved, gently pull back on the stick and the plane lifts off the ground. Landings require a little more practice, but are not as difficult as I once feared. First, set up a stabilized descent toward the runway. Control the airspeed and glide path with the throttle and elevator control. Just above the runway, reduce the rate of descent by lightly pulling back on the stick and then reduce the throttle. Compensate for any crosswind by banking into the wind and use the rudder pedals to yaw the plane so that it touches down with the wheels aligned with the runway. Land with the nose wheel raised and the plane pointed straight. Any pilot's first solo flight is reason for celebration. Mine is even more momentous because of the obstacles I've overcome to achieve this goal. Jennifer requires little motivation to entertain, and since this is also Memorial Day, a barbecue seemed in order. Now at day's end, Dan and I are left to relax on my back patio and enjoy the sight of big billowy thunderheads firing off spectacular flashes over the distant Sierras. With Rich and his family departed, Shannon retreats to help her mother clean up in the kitchen. Dan and I witness nature's impressive fury as we sip margaritas and allow dinner to settle. Hey Dan, what would happen if a jetliner flew through one of those thunderstorms? The one type of weather that all pilots take seriously is thunderstorms. They can really be hazardous. Fortunately, there have been big advances in detection and avoidance of severe weather. Airline pilots have both airborne and ground-based radar and satellite images to help plan their course. And air traffic controllers now have improved weather radar. This can be especially helpful in directing aircraft away from the storms. I've read about a number of incidents of wind shear affecting airliners. Is that still a concern? Wind shear can be a serious byproduct of thunderstorms. It's the sudden change of wind direction and velocity. A new type of Doppler radar has been installed at airports around the country to provide detection. Also, airlines have a training program for pilots that simulate encounters with wind shear and how to escape it. I ponder this for a moment while I savor the perfect blend of margarita and salt. I like my margaritas on the rocks. Jennifer buys a special margarita salt to apply to the lip of the glass. With each sip, I try to get just the right amount of salt granules to roll on my tongue and mash between my teeth. What if lightning hits a plane? Lightning strikes aren't too dangerous. I know it sounds scary, but if an aircraft is hit, it causes little or no harm to the plane and its passengers. I've seen the effects of lightning strikes, and all it amounts to is a small pitted area in the aircraft's metal skin about the size of a dime. Planes are designed in such a way that every metallic part is wired together to allow the flow of electricity to exit through static discharge wicks located on the wings and tail. If you're flying at night, you may see flashes of lightning which are originating from great distances. These flashes can appear to be very close, but are often the result of being reflected through the clouds. Yeah, I think I've seen that once or twice riding in a jetliner, I add. The flashes make it look like you're right in the middle of the storm. Jennifer comes out with a fresh pitcher and offers refills. Are you two wingnuts ready for more to drink? Too bad Rich had to get going. They're sure a fun family. It's nice of them to give Amelia a ride home. She sure enjoyed herself today. Dan smiles at Jennifer and points halfway up his glass. Only a little bit, Mrs. T. I have to drive home soon. I should still have enough salt on the rim of my glass to go along with the complete refill. Thanks, honey. I'll have some more. Jennifer, why don't you join us? I will. I just have to put away a few things and start the dishwasher. With dusk settling in, the storms over the Sierras really begin to put on a show. A chain reaction of lightning rolls from one end of the line of thunderstorms to the other. The bolts aren't visible, but the huge anvils are lit up like nuclear bomb bursts in the gathering darkness. What about other types of clouds, I ask? Are some worse to fly through than others? Dan replies, flying through clouds in a jetliner is kind of cool. Layered stratus clouds are smooth to fly through. Most of the time, you won't feel any bumps at all. When flying through cumulus clouds, you normally feel a bump or two when entering and exiting the cloud. That's because cumulus clouds often have updrafts, and the plane will bounce up a little when flying through these puffy-looking clouds. Another cause of turbulence is the change in air density. Clouds are a little colder than the surrounding air, so the air density is different. Can't ice build up on the wings if it's too cold up there or if a plane flies through snow? Flying in snow is no big deal, and all the jets have anti-icing systems to protect the windshield, wings, tail, engines, and other surfaces from ice. These anti-icing systems use electrical heaters or hot jet engine bleed air to keep the ice off the aircraft. What about heavy rain? I've heard that heavy rain can mean turbulence. Taking another long sip of his drink, Dan replies, "Man, you're full of questions tonight. Turbulence is associated with the heavy rain of thunderstorms. Radar uses raindrops, not clouds, to reflect its beam to display precipitation. Pilots usually give thunderstorms a wide berth of at least 20 miles. If a thunderstorm is near the airport, takeoffs and landings are delayed until the thunderstorm dissipates or moves away. Thunderstorms typically travel across the ground from 10 to 30 miles per hour, so if you wait just a little while, the storm will safely move off the airport. Dan, I know that convective turbulence is caused by hot air rising from the sun heating the ground. I heard that another type of turbulence is caused by different wind currents in the sky. Wind flowing over obstacles such as mountains can also cause turbulence, like water flowing in a river creating eddies. I think we experienced some of that on a smaller scale when we were landing downwind of the willow trees at Dreamland. Yeah, there is a common type of wintertime turbulence called mountain wave. This is produced downwind of large mountain ranges when the jet stream is at a lower altitude. The air mass in the mountain wave will flow up and down a little bit like swells on the sea. This can cause turbulence and is typically found east of the Rocky Mountains. Weather forecasters are good at predicting this type of turbulence because it's easy to track the location of the jet stream. Pilots may change their route or cruising altitude to minimize the mountain wave's effects. Having another sip of my drink and a lick of salt, I say, I used to worry that pilots might lose control of the plane in turbulence, but now that I've learned how to fly through the bumps, I can see that the plane is stable and really isn't difficult to control. What about the higher winds aloft? Dan replies, turbulence can also be caused by shifting wind currents in the sky. When you transition from one wind current to another, such as crossing a front, the air can get stirred up. Planes flying through these transition areas will normally experience some turbulence. Again, it may be annoying, like your questions, but not dangerous, he says with a grin. Man, with all of these questions, I'm going to have to start charging you for personal tutoring. Just then, Jennifer returns with a drink of her own and interrupts. How about I get you another margarita as payment for Mark's lesson? Okay, twist my arm. Despite the many things that Dan taught me before soloing, there is still much to master. I have to learn how to handle the plane in all conditions and circumstances. One maneuver that's critical to learn is the stall. I've come to understand that stalls have been a factor in a number of small airplane crashes. The term stall doesn't refer to the engine, but the wing's lift. For a wing to create lift, it must be angled upward compared to the oncoming relative wind. As this angle is increased, the amount of lift created by the wind increases as well. But once the angle becomes too great, the air can no longer flow smoothly over the top of the wing and it begins to burble and separate. At this point, the amount of lift generated by the wing falls off dramatically and the wing stalls. Stalls are encountered when a pilot neglects to maintain enough airspeed and must pull the nose of the plane up for more lift. Once a stall occurs, the nose of the plane drops, and you have to let the speed build back up to regain the lift. This requires some altitude. Dan has told me that jetliners fly at speeds that allow for large safety margins. He says the planes are equipped with many alert signals and safety systems. When approaching a stall, the jet's computers will sound alarms, flash lights, shake the control stick, and even push the stick and throttles forward if necessary to prevent the stall. In my little plane, I have none of these artificial warnings, but I've learned to recognize the onset of a stall through practice. When approaching a stall, I can feel the breeze on my face diminish as forces on the control stick become lighter. I can also feel the burbling of airflow over the wings from the small rumble transmitted through the airframe. Before my flight training, I would have considered such flight maneuvers frightening, but now I'm able to handle them with confidence. Taking it one step at a time and thoroughly educating myself has enabled me to handle these drills with composure, though the first few times certainly tested my moxie. Over the next couple of months, Dan teaches me other advanced maneuvers such as spins, spirals, and engine-out landings. Occasionally, Rich joins us to fly alongside during my lessons. This experience helps teach me about flying formation. It's challenging to stay close to another airplane, relatively motionless, while operating in the three-dimensional environment of the sky. Steady concentration and focus on the other airplane is necessary, and making gradual flight control and throttle adjustments is essential. After being introduced to these advanced maneuvers, I spend much of the remaining spring and summer months practicing on the weekends. One important and challenging thing I work on is engine-out landings. These practice sessions help build my confidence in the ability of the airplane to glide in a controlled manner while idling the engine to simulate an engine failure. I used to worry that if the engine quit, the plane would plummet to the ground. But now I know that gliding is a natural part of any flight, and even large planes fly just fine with the engine off. Up at altitude, I throttle back to idle to become accustomed to how the plane handles in a glide. I pick out a field or a road as my emergency landing strip. Then I judge my descent so as to land exactly where I've chosen. An important variable I have to account for is wind speed and direction. Without a windsock available, I have to learn to estimate the wind by other means. I carefully observe the effects of the wind on blowing trees, grass, smoke, and dust. I also learn to read the wind's effect on a body of water, noting the size and orientation of waves. When flying out in the open, your natural senses come into play to help make up for the lack of instrumentation. With the onset of warm weather, it's time to install floats onto our planes. I've fallen in love with float flying. It's the smoothest flying out there. The air above a body of water is usually very stable. When flying over water, there's little convective turbulence because the surface below is heated evenly by the sun. The plane will just buzz along, steady as a rock. A plane with floats installed handles just about the same in the air as a plane without floats, except there's a little more added weight and aerodynamic drag. The real trick to float flying is the water taxi. Maneuvering a float plane on the water around boats and docks can be challenging. When there's a breeze, the plane will weather vane or point into the wind. Thus, the planning of the taxi and docking should be thought out ahead of time. With August approaching, the three of us prepare for the annual trip to Lake Monticello. I've worked hard spending all my free weekends and evenings learning everything I can. I feel a great accomplishment to have come so far, and I'm looking forward to using my new skills on our upcoming Odyssey.